Amongst intellectuals in Turkey, the psychologist and author Gündüz Vassaf is a bit of a rock star. He writes a weekly column for the newspaper Radical, was a founding member of the Istanbul chapter of Amnesty International, and resigned from his post as university professor in protest of the 1980 military coup. Born and educated in America, Vassaf is regarded as one of the most important critical voices in Turkey. Currently, he is in town for the Prague Writers' Festival, and we spoke to him ahead of the gala opening. The interview opens with the question of whether he is familiar with the city at all.
Actually, I came here many years ago. It was under socialism, so that must have been about 25 years ago. And I came once more in between, and this is my third time in Prague. And I have to say that of all the cities I've seen in the world, it's the most beautiful man-made city in the world. I think Istanbul is, for instance, a beautiful city because of its nature, the Black Sea, the Sea of Marmara, the Bosphorus, the Golden Horn, the Seven Hills of Istanbul, etc. But Prague is, the scale is human size. It's friendly to you because the buildings are not so big, the streets are not so wide. It's not an imperial city that makes you know your place in the world.
And you are, of course, in town for the Prague Writers' Fest. Could you just talk a bit about what you have prepared and what you will be reading?
I'll be participating in three panel discussions. One of them is on the invisible republic, America. So we'll see how a superpower, an imperial power, can be called invisible. It's a mystery to me too, but we'll discuss it. The other is on Islam, and I know nothing about Islam, but I was at Harvard University last week. And I went to a conference given by one of the professors of Islamic studies at Harvard. The title of the conference was, What is Islam? So his opinion was also that nobody knows what Islam is. So we'll discuss that. And I'll be reading a piece about the Mostar Bridge in Bosnia. This is a bridge that was built in the 15th century, and it was destroyed during the last Balkan Wars. And I was there for 2 months, every day on the bridge, writing about the bridge, 10, 12 hours a day. So I'll be reading a small piece about what I call a bridge watcher's diary.
And you spent some time in my home country, in Germany, which has, of course, a large Turkish community. Maybe you could talk a bit about what the Turkish experience is like in Germany and how it compares to other Western European countries.
It's a unique experience in the history of Europe because it was a very secluded, in a way, very homogeneous community, Europe, since the year 600 or since the year 700, whereas you get communities in the Middle East, in India, etc. You have many religions. In India, you have four or five religions. In Turkey, you had Christians, Orthodox, Catholics, Jews, Zoroastrian people near the Iranian border, etc. The rest of the world really has been used to many religions, many languages, many cultures coming together, whereas Europe was really basically a Catholic continent, Western Europe especially. So the Muslim experience of these people, all of a sudden millions of people going to the schools, millions of Muslims going to schools, going to workplaces, etc., was a very unique experience in the history of Europe. So it takes time for adjustment, and also for the people who came, of course, it's very difficult. It's just as difficult for the people to adjust to come as the people who have been living there for centuries to adjust to the newcomers. Eventually, there will be a multicultural society in Europe, but it's painful.
It's been some 30, 40 years that Germany has had a Turkish community. How has the relationship between Germans and Turks changed in that time span, would you say?
The Germany of today is not really the same Germany that the initial waves of immigration in the 60s, when people from Turkey, Greece, the then Yugoslavia came, because it was a growing Germany, economically very healthy. And now we're at a period where capitalism is actually in a crisis. And when a crisis happens, ethnic differences are always exaggerated and religious identities come to the forefront, which leads to a lot of extremist movements as well. And I think what's happening in Germany now, in France and other countries, Denmark, Norway, with the right becoming politically stronger, is a reaction to the uncertainty of the times, so people become more conservative. But I think it's a passing phase, and if it's a healthier economical system in the world and a more just economical system in the world, where people don't have to fight each other for jobs, then I think the racism will cease to exist.
Well, let's hope you prove right on that point. In 1992, you published the book Hell Be Praised, and it became a bestseller in Turkey. Could you talk a bit about, I believe it deals with totalitarianism. Could you talk a bit about the themes in the book?
The basic theme at that time in Turkey, there had been one of the many military coups that Turkey has had in the last century, one in 61 and 71 and 80 anyway. So I began to see how people, and it's in the German experience as well, it's in the experience of many countries, how people under a totalitarian regime adjust to the military regime, or more than that, how they collaborate. And at one point I realized that more than becoming collaborators with the regime, we adjust to it because we're too powerless to change it. And when you are powerless, then you adjust to it. And once I realized that process of adjustment, I didn't have this rebellious attitude to what I previously called the collaborators with the military regime, amongst my colleagues in the university, in the arts world, etc. Then that led me to thinking about how we adjust to the prisoners that we built for ourselves. So the book is really, the subtitle of the book is Prisoners of Ourselves, how we become prisoners of ourselves with the different mental sets that we create.
Would you say that the communist regimes could be compared to the military dictatorships in Turkey or in other countries? Or would you say there is many different factors that make those two a completely different experience?
I think we fool ourselves too easily with showing examples like the People's Republic of China, the former Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, military regimes in Turkey, South America, etc., calling them totalitarian regimes as if other states of totalitarianism in the so-called democratic countries do not exist. And I think that they very much do exist, because very much in the Western countries and the Western democracies, the freedom of choice is touted, saying we have the freedom of choice. But the choices that you choose from are given by the system. So basically you choose from the choices given to you. And that's not the freedom of choice. For instance, the people in the UK and US do not have the freedom to choose whether their country should go to war or not. The invasion of Iraq by the Anglo-American alliance, basically, the majority of the population in the UK and eventually the US was very much against the war. Yet in the UK, the cradle of democracy, both the government party and the opposition party were for the war. So you have this case where the people are against the war, but the government is for the war. So is that choice? I mean, it's not that people choose the war, just the opposite.
And you actually resigned from teaching in protest of the military coup in Turkey. What role does activism play in your life, and why did you make that decision?
I don't consider it activism. I know in my short biography for the festival, the word activism is associated to my name, but it's more a state of being comfortable with my conscience than activism.
So you felt that you could no longer have a clean conscience and go on executing your job?
That, and I could not, I think, physically execute my job, because the military, unfortunately, has their job, but as an academic at the university, I never interfere with the military in the sense that if you're going to attack somebody, this is what you should do, this is not what you should not do, etc. But the military attacked the universities, saying these are dangerous books, this is what should be taught, this is not what should not be taught. So the university lost its freedom, its autonomy. And there was no place for me there when the university, which is based on critical thinking, cannot exist under a totalitarian regime.
And I read a line by you on the festival's webpage where you write, "In the course of that time, my experience with Islam has followed a zigzag course, a consequence of both my personal development and political events." And I would like to ask you, what role has Islam played in your life?
Well, in the beginning, almost nil, almost nothing, because the Turkish Republic was very much set up as a secular state. One was not even aware of religion, whether Islam or Judaism or Christianity. That was and you never saw people praying, at least in the cities. So I was brought up from my parents as well, without religion. And eventually, when I was, I think, studying abroad in Washington, where I had this sort of identity crisis as to who I am, and at one point I found myself, just for a couple of weeks, fasting and having the Turkish flag in my car, flying it inside the car, actually, where the coat hangers were, looking who I am. Am I American? Am I Turkish? Etc. So I had this sort of flirtatious relationship for a couple of weeks. And outside of that, of course, Islam is becoming more of a political issue throughout the world. But I look upon now Islam more sociologically, certainly, and more culturally than religion, because the function and the role of religion changes across centuries and across years.
I believe that economically, Turkey right now is really thriving. It's doing very well. How would you describe the cultural status quo of Turkey at this moment?
The Republic was built on repudiating its Ottoman past. So the first 10, 15 years of the Republic, which was set up in the early 1920s, was looking upon the Ottoman sultans as traitors, and non-Turks as well, because it was the Ottoman family, the royal family. So the beginning of the Republic was non-Ottoman, non-Islamic, secular, Turkish students, because citizens, with the government trying to create a Turkish identity for the Armenians, for the Greek Turks, for the Jews, etc., that everybody, Kurds, that everybody was to be called a Turk and to have a Turkish identity. And of course, as time passes and one becomes comfortable with the distance from the monarchy, from the empire, then people begin to look at their past. In the 1930s, for a young person to want to study Ottoman history would be considered as if someone was looking at the history of witchcraft or something like that. Now you can have Ottoman historians in Turkey, and with the economical strengthening of Turkey, they're now looking more at their Ottoman past and more proud of their Ottoman past. And of course, being proud of a past brings chauvinism with it. So it's whereas in the beginning Turkey had and Turkish culture to a degree had an inferiority complex to the West, trying to catch up with the West, etc. Now there's a superiority complex to the West, that Turkey has a strong economy and the might of the mighty history of the empire behind the people.